Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show where we demonstrate that simply everything has its own history, like tea, taps and eggs.
Or rain, strain and stain. It's a wet one today and I feel like a drowned rat. Or annoyance, annoyance, annoyance. Sam, I am singularly vexed after Friday night. And one lady after the show had the temerity to come up to me and correct my pronunciation. You know, you put all your love and energy into entertaining an audience, and one particular individual feels the need to come up to you afterwards and say, by the way,
tell you what you've done wrong.
It's lieutenant, not lieutenant.
I think we should do the history of pronunciation.
I think we should do the history
and
of pronunciation.
Also annoyance and toleration.
Or rants.
It was nice of her to come and let us know.
I felt so comforted by it. We will be following, however, the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam, that the history of fire is all about the Reformation, civilization, Vietnam, and cultural awakenings? Ooh. Or that the history of Wales, this is the sea thing, rather than the nation, the great nation. The history of Wales is all about perfume, migration, discovery and fables and long classics that are like reading through treacle.
The man sitting opposite me, ladies and gentlemen, he is the Buckland Abbey of history. He's the home of Tudor history. Buckland Abbey being where Francis Drake lived.
Yes. Oh, clever.
Not bad.
Clever.
I've just discovered, actually, it was built in the 13th century, which I had no idea about.
It was an abbey that was then dissolved during the Reformation and then went into secular use. The man sitting opposite me is the Charles Howard of Effingham, the Royal and Lord Admiral himself, man of seafaring stories, the wonderful historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis.
That is interesting, but wrong.
Is it?
Yeah, because he was not an experienced sailor. It's one of the interesting things about the Armada. People not doing the right jobs.
Apparently he was quite a good leader, though, and gave aristocratic heft to it.
Yes, he did. He did.
Yes, but there are tales that he threw up aboard ship, which are apparently wrong. Mm-hmm. I think it's people trying to sort of, you know, sow seeds of misinformation. Fake news is an old thing.
But that
thing
is interesting as well. It's like people saying that being sick on a ship is some kind of a bad thing and makes you not the right kind of man to do the job, which is nonsense.
I get very seasick.
Yeah, I do as well. I feel terrible.
Really?
Yeah.
But you've been all over the place on ships.
You still feel seasick. Nelson was seasick.
Oh.
Yeah. Doesn't make you a lesser man.
No, absolutely not. I have no trouble with my sense of masculinity because I can't.
I thought you did.
Because I fear heights and
I'm
get seasick.
I'm terrified of heights.
Really?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Absolutely terrified.
In what way?
I'm afraid of them.
No. But there's a kind of rational sort of,
afraid
a dangerous
that a height
job.
Is going to come and beat me to death in the street.
I'm afraid that I'm going to hurl myself off. There's what a lot of people who suffer from vertigo. It's not this sort of rational sense that you're there's a long drop and you may trip or anything. It's that you are drawn to the edge.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's that you will do silly things.
No, I just become kind of paralysed. I get very sweaty palms and I get very, very frightened. And actually, when I was younger, everyone, I learned to sail square rigged ships and I spent a lot of time on board ships sailing. And climbing up aloft was, I think, the most difficult thing I've had to overcome in my life. And I hated it
But you did it.
I did it, yeah.
So you've, but you've been, you have been all over the place, climbing on all sorts of tall things and up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great Walls
but
of China.
It's getting worse. The older I get, the more.
I'm getting worse as I get older. My 7-year-old is just laughs at me. I'm, you know, and can just go up anything. But I'm just, you know, dreadful. Anyway, we digress.
We do a little.
A tad.
James and I were talking at the Gloucester History Festival at the weekend, and it was very, very lovely talking in a priory.
It was absolutely brilliant.
And before that, I gave a talk on the Spanish Armada, because I've just written a little book on the Armada, and there were loads of people there. The place was full. Maybe another, a couple of schools came along. So I decided we'd do a little thing, an unexpected history of the Spanish Armada.
Sam, I have your book here. Mm. This is the Ladybird expert book, The Spanish Armada. This looks, to me, like it's quite small. I think it would fit beautifully in a Christmas stocking.
I think it probably would. Right,
quick
so
plug.
What do you think the normal or expected history of the Spanish Armada is? I mean, I think we should start off with what's kind of obvious before we decide to go at it from a slightly different perspective.
It's a kind of rivalry between England and Spain,
yeah.
An economic rivalry, so there's that. It's there's a sort of standard build-up to it. There's the way in which the English are plundering the Spanish ships. There's a difference in religion. So you've got Protestant England. You've got Catholic Spain. Quite close relationships between them, though, because, you know, don't forget that you know, that there have been lots of Anglo-Spanish marriages. Catherine of Aragon married not just one Tudor monarch, but two. She married Henry VIII, which everyone knows about, but fewer people know that she actually married his brother, Arthur, who was supposed to be king. And then, of course, there's Mary Tudor, who marries Philip of Spain, who is, in fact, the man, you know, sending the Armada over. There's then all the sort of maritime history, the sort of military side of things, and the sort of the strategy and the plan for sailing over and meeting up with Palmer's 30,000 troops. There's then the history of how that went. So there's that sort of standard yeah. history, which you know infinitely better than I.
No, well, the point is there is a standard way of doing it, and I think people at school will be learning the sort of the basic tropes of what goes on in the Armada. So who's expected to win, why they're fighting, and what happens,
yes,
basically.
Exactly.
You can look at the aftermath of it as well. You can look at all the shipwrecks. You can look at the maritime yeah. archaeology. But we like doing things from a slightly different perspective,
yes.
don't we?
Yes. And if you were, but before that, if you were looking at the standard narrative of it, you've got the set piece Tilbury speech, which you might be asked to look at. You've got the Armada portrait, all of those kinds of things.
Yeah,
yeah.
So I've just been thinking about this, the way that we can look at it in a different way, and I think that the Armada is all about collapsed expectation, panic,
ooh.
Smell, beards, and fabric. I suddenly realised that fabric is actually everywhere and affects everything we ever do in history.
Well, for me, it's about fire, the post, propaganda, spectacle, and xenophobia.
Mm. Yeah?
It's totally about xenophobia.
It is.
It's about scary Spaniards.
Should we start with that? Because that's a bit like what it's to do with panic as well.
That is a bit... that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We can start with that.
Do you want to start about beacons?
I wasn't going to start about beacons. I was going to start with... well, there's beacons as well, but there's also... I can start with beacons.
Let's start with beacons, because I reckon we can then talk about panic and xenophobia
okay.
at the same time.
So the idea behind the beacon system is...
what is the beacon system?
The beacon system is you have along the coast and also inland, you have a series of beacons. In other words, you have these sort of tall metal baskets that would have had sort of wood in them. And when you had a sighting of a ship or an enemy, you would light the beacon.
So the flames would light up, but also they would chuck out gallons
yeah.
of smoke, and
yeah,
you'd
yeah.
be able to see the smoke for 25 miles away.
For 25 miles
so
away.
So then it would bounce across hilltop yeah. to hilltop. Yeah.
And if you sighted, you know, a small number of vessels, one beacon would be lit. If you sighted, you know, more than two or three, so sort of flotilla, two beacons would be lit, and if you saw three, three beacons would be lit if you saw an army actually invading. Now, if you look at some of the evidence, particularly down in Plymouth and particularly down in Devon and the local Lord Lieutenant the evidence is that people didn't actually light the beacons down in Devon for fear that what that would do would be set off panic among the people of Devon. You know, they would go absolutely berserk.
So there's a really interesting point about this, and the first is that if anything, the Tudors were pragmatists, right? So the likelihood of being invaded by sea was very high. So it would actually cause panic because people thought there was a genuine likelihood that they were going to be invaded. I think that's a point.
Yes.
So between the Norman Conquest, 1066, and 1588, when the Spanish Armada comes, England has been invaded by sea, leading to a change in ruling power 8 times. So the Tudors themselves invaded by sea.
Yes.
Henry Tudor came across in a boat with a fleet.
I believe you on that 8. I believe you. Yeah, I'm sure it is.
Henry Tudor himself came across on a boat before Bosworth, before he fights Richard III and he ends the Wars of the Roses. He's invaded by sea. So if anyone knows this is true, it's the damn Tudors. They know that that's how they actually secured the country. So the point is it's actually quite likely. And you're chipping around, minding your own business in Devon.
Yeah.
And suddenly your life, your religion, your houses, your families, everything is under threat.
So
that is linked with xenophobia, isn't it?
It is linked with xenophobia. I mean, it's partly because there are close links between Spain and England, not only dynastic, but also through religion. There are a large number of Catholics who are still living in England, despite the, you know, change of religion towards a sort of Church of England that we can trace back to Henry VIII and see through Edward VI. Mary sort of takes the country back to Rome, the church in Rome, and then Elizabeth comes along and we have an Elizabethan settlement that establishes the Anglican Church.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the 1570s, Catholicism is outlawed. So there are recusancy rules passed. And a recusant is somebody who obdurately sticks with their religion and refuses to outwardly conform or refuses to conform. And they can be penalised for it. There is a fear among the English government, but also a sort of suspicion among the Spaniards that a large number of English Catholics will rise up in support of a Spanish invasion, to reassert Catholicism, and also as a reaction to the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots. If you have a look at some of the archaeology of the ships that went down during the Armada, there are some pretty lavish swords with bejeweled hilts on them. And these, it was thought, were supposed to be gifts to the aristocratic Catholics
who would
rise up. There are all sorts of things. There are English Catholics who are actually on the Armada vessels as well.
Some of which are English. Not many, but there are a few.
But there are a few, and there are a number of merchants in Bristol who were persecuted because they put profit above country, and basically they give, they start selling arms to the Armada. But this is connected to xenophobia because the reaction of the English government is basically to demonise the Spaniards. And there is a Catholic tract by Cardinal William Amlan called The Admonition to the Nobility and People of England and Ireland, basically getting people to rise up against the English crown. And Elizabeth is demonized in this pamphlet as an incestuous bastard begotten and born in sin of an infamous courtesan, Anne Boleyn. So this is published. And in reaction to this, we have a number of pamphlets that come out sort of saying, you know, don't listen to this sort of Catholic propaganda. You know, when the Spaniards invade, it will be pretty awful. And I'm going to read you a little extract here from Henry Barrow's A Brief Discourse. What favour can English Catholics then expect of a foreign army, especially of the Spanish soldier, who, in the opinion and report of those nations which have felt his fury and endured his yoke, is very hardly thought of and almost infamous for his pride, insolence, cruelty, ravishments, and such like kinds of violence? Small favour or courtesy, God wot, is an Englishman to hope for at a Spaniard's hand, be he never so Catholic? The Spanish soldier, where he is lord, never useth to ask or to hear whose wife is this, whose daughter, whose sister, whose house, or whose goods are these. A Catholic's wife, daughter, house, and goods are as sweet to him as another man's. And what pleasure would this be to an Englishman, whatsoever his religion be, to see his wife forced, his sisters ravished, his daughters deflowered, his house sacked, his goods pilled and spoiled by a stranger before his face. So it's basically saying you let these people, these Spaniards in, and they will basically rape and steal from you. Mm. And there's a propaganda, there's a proclamation that that Walsingham issues around the time of the Armada, basically saying that when the Spaniards come, they will torture you. And he's so graphic about the descriptions of women being raped and children above the age of 7 being branded in the face. So it's really trying to perpetuate this sense of fear of an invading force, of an outsider.
And the controlling the panic, the point is they don't light the beacons. Yes. So the way the beacons are supposed to work is if you see a ship, you light it.
Yeah.
And it's well known that these beacons are lit, but they weren't lit, specifically because they were afraid of causing panic.
Yeah.
And actually, the state's fear of panic being caused, and that would then affect the English ability to fight off the Spanish.
Yes.
That's part of a history of panic, which is fascinating.
Yeah.
I've got a lovely little quote here. The people are panic-stricken, all that could have left. The poor are nearly all on our hands. There's no money in the city treasury. All pecuniary aid will be thankfully received. Fever is increasing. Samuel Levy, mayor. And that was written to a senator, Senator J.R. West of Louisiana, in America in 1873. It's very interesting, back in his state. It's all to do with the fear of disease, cholera, yellow jack. And when disease came, that was as influential in disrupting life and making sort of the rules of life, the order that kept everything together, completely collapsed. That was a massive problem as late as 1873. So we're talking about 1588. This is 300 years later, and there are people hugely concerned about the impact of panic, which is caused by disease, let alone an invading army.
But
it's all part of the same story, isn't it? Same story.
It's anarchy.
It is.
And the breakdown of the structures of government and society. Yes, absolutely.
But there's another little story linked with this. This is panic caused by illness.
Yeah.
So once the Royal Navy, once Drake and his others actually come to grips with the Spanish for the first time in the far west of the Channel.
Yes.
Something really interesting happens. A ship is captured called the Rosario.
Yes.
And another ship, the San Salvador, explodes.
Yeah.
This allows the English onto the Spanish ships, and thereafter it utterly transforms their tactical strategic approach to dealing with the Spanish Armada. And one of the things they find out is that the ships stink and the sailors are diseased. And this causes such immediate panic that, that all of the English sailors get off the San Salvador. They have nothing to do with it. They just leave it alone. They didn't capture it. They didn't take it back. They simply left it. However, this knowledge that they kept brought with them, they didn't want to infect their own fleet, utterly changed the way they dealt with the Spanish Armada. And thereafter, they're much less standoffish, literally. I mean, they really get involved, and they become much less afraid of the Armada. So they know the Armada's coming, you see, because of all of the intelligence that's come to Walsingham. Then the point is, they know the Armada's coming in terms of the number of ships, but they don't know what condition it's in.
No.
So they're terrified of it,
completely
bricking themselves. Yes. And then when they actually get on a ship, they're like, well...
They're not organised.
They're all going to die, basically. Yeah. I mean, the men on board are dying already. They're the ships are kind of crewed by skeletons, basically.
I was also reading some of the archaeology about it, about the ships, and some of the finds that have been made off the Irish coast, and some of those ships show evidence of basically just ill preparation.
Yeah.
You know, the wrong kinds of cannons and all that sort of thing. One of the reasons that the English knew about the Spanish Armada was because a lot of the correspondence was written in secret codes. And Thomas Phillips, that guy who we talked about with when we talked about Mary Queen of Scots and the Babington plot, he's Walsingham's master code cracker. He gets hold of the Armada codes and breaks them. It's one of the most famous things he's most famous for. So the Armada is all about codes.
And smells.
I mean,
that smells actually is a really interesting point. So, do you know what scrofula smells like?
No, but I can imagine.
We've talked about scrofula before, haven't we?
Oh, God, the seeping pore on the... Yes.
In terms of...
It's the king's evil. So it's a skin-wasting disease.
Right.
And the poor who were suffering from it would come along to royal ceremonies.
And if
the king touched them, they would...
That's it.
The royal touch would cure them of scrofula.
Well, scrofula smells like stale beer.
Oh, not too bad then.
What about typhoid fever?
Mustard.
Baked bread.
Mm.
Yeah. Yellow fever?
Curry?
A butcher's shop.
Ooh.
Oh, remember that
what
kind
period?
Of meaty...
Yeah, but it's sort of, you know, like, sort of... I mean, but in terms of
whether
it's
the butcher's
sort of
shop.
Butcher's shop pre-refrigeration.
Yeah, but it'll have that... It'll have that metallic tang of blood.
Fungy.
Oh, God. Diphtheria? What does that smell like?
Oh, probably like chicken. Most things smell like chicken.
Diphtheria, smells sweet... And then the inability to metabolize methionine. It smells like boiled cabbage, apparently.
Ooh, yeah.
But those are pretty unpleasant smells. And I think you'd notice that there would have been a very distinctive... It wouldn't have just been smelly.
Yes.
It would have been... These English sailors would have smelt something which would have immediately alarmed them. And they would have gone, actually, we've got a serious problem on this ship, so we're off.
Yes.
So it's all to do with smells as well.
It's all to do with spectacle.
Yes.
Spectacle and deceit, because one of the interesting things is about the Tilbury speech. So the Tilbury speech, which, the date of it is the 18th of August, and the Queen leaves London, goes to Tilbury, where all the troops are massing. Meanwhile, the Spanish fleet is being sort of chased up the Irish Sea, up towards Scotland. So, some of the thinking is that they've actually gone and they're no longer a threat. But you know, I think in terms of what we know about the potency of that force, they probably still are a threat. But nonetheless, Elizabeth, more or less in safety, is there with all these troops and does this sort of rabble-rousing speech, to try and gird their sort of loins and... You know, make them be courageous. And in fact, she's doing it in relative safety. But I'll just read you an extract from the speech. My loving people, we've been persuaded by some that are careful of our safety to take heed how we commit ourselves to armed multitudes for fear of treachery. But I assure you, I do not desire to live to distrust my faithful and loving people. Let tyrants fear. I have always so behaved myself that under God I have placed my chiefest strength and safeguard in the loyal hearts and goodwill of my subjects. And therefore I come amongst you, as you see at this time, not for my recreation and disport, but being resolved in the midst and heat of the battle to live and die amongst you all, to lay down for my God and for my kingdom and my people, my honour and my blood, even in the dust. I know, and this is the famous bit, I know I have the body but of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and of a king of England too, and think foul scorn that Parma or Spain or any prince of Europe should dare to invade the borders of my realm, to which rather than any dishonour shall grow by me, I myself will take up arms. I myself will be your general, judge and rewarder of every one of your virtues in the field. This is interesting in several ways. Not only the Spanish Armada is miles away and probably no longer any threat, it's also interesting in terms of how we think about the gender of monarchy and the kinds of roles that a queen might play. We have a woman on a battlefield here with a male breastplate on, armoured breastplate, presenting herself in very martial military terms. So that's absolutely key. The other thing is there's a raging debate among academics about whether this is actually authentic, whether these were Elizabeth's words used on the battlefield here, or whether it's in an entirely fictionalised account. And the latest research says that this is actually not authentic. These are the words that historians wanted to be remembered. So when you see it reported later on, this is the version that's been put forward after the event. So that's a form of propaganda.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, very interesting.
I just want to come back to fabric quickly. Have a look
at
that.
What you got? Oh, goodness me, what's that? It looks like the Turin Shroud.
It's cool, isn't it?
What is it?
It's a naval banner.
Oh, I love it.
It's a flag that was flown at the Armada. It's one of only two 16th century flags to actually survive. The other one comes from the Battle of Lepanto in 1572.
I've got some great fabric stuff.
This is cool. This came off a Spanish ship that was wrecked on the sort of Flanders banks, and it ended up in a church in Leiden. Mm. It's about 3.5 metres long. The original would have been 12.5 metres long, they reckon.
Gosh.
And
that's long.
What's important about this, right, is if you look at images of naval battle from this period, it's quite easy to kind of stop and overlook what is actually grabbing you in the eyes here. Have a look at this one. This is one of the well-known contemporary accounts of the Armada at the Battle of Gravelines. So you've got maybe, 70 ships are depicted here. And the one thing that really gets you is actually they're 90% fabric. Aren't they? All of these sails, every single one of them has got banners and flags. Yeah. And, I mean, there is. You think of naval battle as being all about wooden ships and iron cannons.
Yeah.
It's not. It's actually as much as about soft and lost material, which is why that flag is so important, because it actually makes us stop and realise how important flags and banners were in battles
Symbolism.
Like that. Not only that, but that flag that was flown in the Armada, archaeologists now think is 100 years old.
Yeah.
Was 100 years old in 1588. So it was a flag that was made in 1488, 1485 maybe.
Yeah.
So the Catholics are putting on a display of military might in the same way they've been doing for over 100 years.
Hmm.
And it makes you realise just how important these kind of flags and banners were to that kind of conflict. It was as much soft as it was hard.
And I suppose that also you've got to think about tactics for dealing with that fabric.
Yeah.
Militarily, so how do you take the wind out of people's sails and the kind of cannonballs that would have gone through that?
Mm.
I saw a brilliant talk on cannonballs at the Vasa Museum, which I think we've spoken about, and cannonballs that would kind of come in two parts. And the idea was not that you'd knock holes necessarily in the war in the ship itself, but that you'd basically split the sails.
Yeah.
But for me, the Armada is all about post.
Well, then.
It's all about the postal system. Now, this is it's partly a matter of communication. Now, this is where the Duke of Parma and the chap running the navy, Sidonis,
Medina Sidonia.
Yeah. Can't communicate with each other, despite the fact that they're sending mail backwards and forwards, but they're not receiving it. Also, Philip down in Spain is unable to sort of really get decent messages across because the way in which post was carried was by horse throughout this period. And so you were, if you think about the way in which there's no postal system, so you're looking at people riding on horseback from one postal hub to another on a particular designated route, changing horses and then going on to the next. And it actually means that communication is very, very slow. We can see the way in which London would have communicated with the people on the English ships because we have letters that survive. I've got here an example signed by William Lord Burghley to the Lord Admiral sent from London on the 26th of August, and it's basically a letter that is asking the Lord Admiral to sort of give news of what's happening, and we can see exactly how long it takes to communicate because at every single postal stage, the postmaster has signed, docketed on the outside of the letter, the time that it was received.
That's fascinating.
And so we can see that it's left London on the 26th of August at 9 in the morning. It's then reached Dartford at 2 in the afternoon, Rochester at 5, Sittingbourne past 6, Canterbury past 8. And so it's basically, you can follow its journey all the way down the postal road. And when we talked about letters, I think we mentioned this, that you can actually map how long the country is and how wide it is in postal days.
That's interesting.
It's all about that.
Postal geography.
Well, I feel we could carry on for some time, James, but I think it's also time for us to wrap up here.
I feel we could.
We could. Maybe we'll come back to the Armada, but it's really nice touching on it and saying that there are all sorts of different ways you can
do it. We haven't even talked about the Armada portrait, which people should look at. Armada portrait with the pictures of the Armada
in
behind
the
Elizabeth.
Portrait
in the background.
Of Elizabeth I. Yep. Yes, it's in Greenwich. It's brilliant. And also collapsed expectation. I wanted to talk about that. There are so many different ways of looking at this. I think I'm going to come back to collapsed expectation.
Yes.
Basically,
I think
Armada was a massive disappointment for the Spanish and a massive disappointment for the English, and in this period everything was pretty much disappointing.
Yes. But it's not the only Armada, is it? There were many Armadas afterwards.
No, it's not the only Armada. You need to look at 1595 and 1596, the most immediate ones, and then look all the way up to things like 1777.
Yes.
American Revolution.
And in fact, very soon after the Spanish Armada, the English went down to Spain to try and invade there as well.
They did. They're all
and it failed.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very, very difficult waging war in this period.
And then they gave up to fight France.
Let's leave it there. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoyed that. Do please get in touch with our Armada stories. There's plenty of Armada stuff in our new Histories of the Unexpected, the Tudors book, which you can also have a look at.
There's the Armada in our live Tudors show, which we'll be touring very soon.
Absolutely, we're rehearsing at the moment. I think we're going to do a dedicated podcast on the development of the Tudors show, because we're sitting here with two massive pieces of rope in the corner over there.
Brilliant.
They're smelly, aren't they? Very smell of hemp and coir.
I think I just smell like damp dog today, so I can't smell anything.
It would be very, very kind of you if you could spare a couple of dollars a month for our Patreon account. We're saving up to get some better recording equipment. We currently record in the shed down the end of my garden, and I live near a train line. We have to stop every 15 minutes because the train goes past. It's so annoying. And we'd like to be able to at least rent out a recording studio to do it in. If you could just please donate a couple of dollars a month, it would make all the difference. You could find us on patreon.com/histories of the unexpected. That's all for now.
They can also follow us on Twitter.
You can, at Unexpected Pod.
Unexpected Pod, and at James Daybell, and at Dr. Sam Willis, and our brilliant website.
Yes, historiesoftheunexpected.com. It's all there.
Brilliant.
Have a lovely day, everyone. Speak to you soon. Bye.
Bye.